The last case on our calendar is 07-1913, Christina Lynn Baird versus Brian Kelly Knuckles. Mr. Patterson.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be in this facility. It's beautiful. I guess I come here in a fairly unusual position. There's four briefs filed and they all pretty much agree. That's probably doesn't happen too frequently.
Rare case here we have with both parties agreeing.
You must be a very powerful advocate, is all I can figure out.
I doubt that, but I'm persistent. because I've lost all the way up, you realize, of course.
You got here.
I did. And I thank you for that. And the reason I do is because I think this is a very important issue for families. It's an issue that comes up very frequently. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes at the end of...
Watch your time there on the clock.
The briefs are very good. I agree with almost everything that's been written about it. There's a little chisel here and a little chisel there, maybe that I don't agree with, but... I particularly agree with the Ohio Child Support Directors Association analysis. It's very good. There's something interesting in this case that I actually just noticed this morning. There are two cases that are referred to. One is the Nelson v. Nelson case, and the other one is the Eclif versus Walters case. Both were written by the same judge, Judge Ford. And as you compare the two cases, it's kind of interesting to see where he's moved over the years on this issue. He has moved from kind of a, you know, we got so many factors out there that we're looking at and we've got an agreement and so forth. But then he moves really to a contract analysis of the issue, satisfaction, whether there's elements, and so forth. I believe that the court should reverse this case and send it back to the trial court with an order to approve the agreement.
There, as I understand it, Mr. Patterson, there is no implication of any subsidy or government subsidy monies involved in the agreement between the parties. Do I have that understanding correct?
Yes, that's important, and that is correct. This, and so what does that mean? That means that this is the party's money. It's not the government's money.
Is there any implication of a poundage fee for the court involved in this agreement between the
parties? Absolutely not.
Parties?
It's totally the party's money. And that's important.
This is also a step-parent adoption, so that the prohibition against payment for adoption does not come into play in this case either. Is that correct?
I'm having a little difficulty.
This is a step-parent adoption. Is that correct?
Yes.
So the prohibition in the adoption statute about essentially paying or buying adoption does not come into play in this case either.
I don't believe so. Nobody's raised that issue.
Counsel, the in just thinking about this issue generally and laying the statute aside for the moment, and we'll have to deal with that because the Court of Appeals thought the statute left no option, but assuming it does leave the option, shouldn't the proper outcome be that these are okay to do subject to court approval, leaving the court a role to examine whether or not there may have been some undue influence behind the scenes that causes the mother in this case to come into court and ask something to be blessed that she's really
an interesting...
Has a gun to her head behind the scenes. So wouldn't there be an appropriate role for the court to at least inquire as to that before blessing it?
To take your question and generalize it, the question is, do you start trying to figure out what all the factors are, or do you start with something simple and kind of work into it? I believe you start with something simple in this case. The question you're asking is essentially what, I'm going to rephrase it terribly, what do you have to put a satisfaction on record of a judgment? You only have to have the parties sign off, not the judge, and go file it. You don't even see the judge. And that's what this is. This is a satisfaction of a judgment. You either have to throw out the whole judgment law as it relates to child support, or you have to bring it in as a judgment and then deal with it as a judgment. This is a satisfaction of a judgment. You don't see the judge. The judge doesn't ask you any questions. You know, is your satisfaction approved by everybody? If it's not, you'll get
but it wasn't filed as a satisfaction in court, though, was it?
I'm sorry?
It was not filed as a satisfaction in court, if
no.
I understand.
No. Right. Traditionally, in our county, we have just come and brought these in and put on a hearing, and the parties are in agreement, and it's granted. It's granted quite frequently.
Well, the difficulty I think the court has was with the language specifically, 31-1983, that says a court may not retroactively modify an obligor's duty to pay a delinquent support payment. And that doesn't leave much room for ambiguity.
No, it doesn't.
So how do we reckon that with your where you are?
All right. First of all, it's the court is not doing it. It's the parties that are doing it. The court, and when you look at it like maybe from the point of view of what's the standard of review, abuse of discretion, you kind of have to analyze it from the point of view of, well, did the judge properly do it? But the we're really in contract circumstances, law, and the contract is, did the court err? And that's the second Judge Ford case, and he even raises that point. And I guess this is the appropriate time for me to kind of jump on the sword on my second proposition. I think that I missed it. I think it should be not abuse of discretion, but, whether or not the trial court erred, which is... Judge Ford says. When I back into it and look at it from that point of view, if I look at release law, release of a judgment, so forth and so on, we come back with very simple situations, which is why I recast your question, Judge.
Coming back to that, so you say the approach has been custom has been until this got turned down is that you'd come in with this, have a little hearing.
Yes.
And that would take care of the issue that I'm raising. If there's a little hearing, there's a chance for the judge to say to this woman, inquire a little more about the circumstances to have a comfort level that there isn't some undue and inappropriate influence being brought to bear. Satisfied with that, puts on the entry. If the judge determines, hey, there's something really rotten going on behind the scenes, refuse to accept it and lay out the reasons.
Judge, when you look at it from that point of view, you're treating this type of a judgment differently.
Well,
I know
kids
that
are
you're
involved
aware
and,
that
and,
all the litigants that deal with judgments, just judgments, of money judgments, small claims, all that stuff. I mean, they're of every ilk in the world. I mean, some of them are crazy.
We do treat these judgments differently. You have to pay it through the court. You got to pay poundage. You don't have to do that with other judgments.
It comes back to what the issue is in relation to child support. The child CSEA has a duty to administer these orders and to keep the records. All we're doing is dealing with the records-keeping function, just like the clerk of courts. If there's something going wrong, if there's some people come to court sometimes and lie, of course, but you know, you don't know necessarily what it is, but there shouldn't be a presumption that you start off someplace else and you work your way back to, you know, a simple satisfaction of a judgment. That's kind of...
Well, this is not, though, a simple satisfaction of a judgment. And you're trying to engraft just basic contract law onto a provision that involves a third party that's normally not involved in a judgment between A and B. You have a third party, you have a child, and the court has an obligation, I think, to look at the child's situation and make sure that this is not done that somehow violates the rights of the child. I don't care if it's a contract action between an ex-spouse and otherwise. So for you to say we should just treat it like an accord and satisfaction kind of takes out the role of the child, and the whole purpose of the support obligation was ever granted in the first place was to take care of the child.
I appreciate your thought on that, but I don't...
And you tell me that that's what's happening now. You have to go before the judge, and the judge, most of the time you said, grants them. When does the judge not grant them? Why does the judge not grant them? Because they see something that makes it not a true accord and satisfaction because maybe there's fraud or coercion. That's still basic contract law, according to you, but a judge can take a look at that and determine was there true accord and satisfaction or was there undue influence that made it not a true accord and satisfaction.
The judge doesn't take a look at any satisfaction before he grants it. Now, if somebody raises an issue when it's the satisfaction is sent out, then the judge can look at it, of course. But on the first cut, you just file the satisfaction with the clerk. In our county, a judge doesn't have to sign it. The satisfaction is sent to under local rules to our judges, where they note it on their cards, and then it's sent back down. They don't approve it. They don't have a hearing on it. And I believe that that's where we should be on these.
Mr. Pattison, it seems that you're backing away from your first proposition then. The way it's stated, you have it that the out-of-court voluntary agreement shall be adopted by the court, and then you have the proviso. If the court finds proper consideration for the agreement, or, and this is, I think, what Justice Pfeiffer is getting to, the agreement is reasonable. As I read your first proposition, I thought you were saying that the court does have the responsibility here to take a look at it before approving it, and then the court shall approve it, which is in line with what the amici are saying as well. And now in your argument, it appears that you're saying once the order is presented, it's just automatically approved and that's it.
I, quite frankly, after reviewing the Directors Association brief and further reading in the law, I've come to that conclusion.
So you are, in effect, suggesting that proviso of your Proposition 1 in your brief should be dropped?
Or at least interpreted as I've indicated. But I believe that I comply with it, whichever way. All the briefs pretty much come to the conclusion that my client came to court and did what was necessary in terms of presenting evidence to obtain the result.
Counsel, what about the best interest of the child test? Do you see room for that here?
Actually not. I think that the Butler County brief addresses that. The parents have an obligation and a presumption that they're acting in the best interest.
Well, I think they have an obligation. I don't know if there's a presumption there that...
Yeah, I'd like to reserve a couple seconds here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Pattison. Mr. Santin.
Good morning. Excuse me. May it please the court, my name is Edward Santin. I'm here this morning representing the Claremont County Child Support Enforcement Agency. I think the prime operative fact here is that these parties did in fact agree to reduce this child support arrearage. There was a valid agreement. It was stated on the record. All kinds of variations on the facts of retroactively modifying arrearages, but I think it's important to keep the focus on the limited facts of this case, and the issue that we are talking about is, can parents agree to waive arrearage? Can that agreement be given effect?
What is the obligation of the court in that situation? As I mentioned, the proposition originally seemed to suggest that the court shall adopt it if it finds the agreement is reasonable. And now we hear something different. What is the CSEA's
I do not view? Believe that the court has an obligation to oversee that process. And Mr. Patterson is partially correct in that sometimes it does happen that there is a hearing. In this instance, the father filed a motion to mitigate the arrearage, I think was the title. But it can happen other ways. And Butler County's brief, they describe what they call a forgive and forget. Their practice and our practice in many instances is if the custodial parent will come in and say, I want to forgive the arrearage. We say we need you to write a notarized statement, sworn to, signed. We will then file that with a motion and entry that does not require hearing. That is still our practice in the domestic relations court, I should say.
And that's provided that there's no state money involved here, correct?
That's correct. Although the state is in the midst of promulgating regulations, which will give us instruction on when the state will agree to forgive arrearages, which should informs the issue, I might add. I mean, the Ohio State Office of Child Support believes that arrearages can be forgiven by agreement, notwithstanding this statute. And this is the state office which is, in effect, responsible for complying with the statutes. The other way that this can come up, and I can't give you a percentage of how many require a small hearing and how many are the notarized statement. The other way it comes up, and it's frequent, is in contempt hearings, where frequently it's the father that owes the back support. We bring father in for a contempt. Father brings mother with him, and mother says, you know what, I'm going to give him a break. I'd rather he visit the child, or he'll never catch up. I want to forgive the support. And it happens basically on the spot, impromptu. Now, there are situations, I have seen situations where it just doesn't feel right, where it seems that mom is under some kind of duress. And I have also seen the court in that instance deny.
What happened here? Why did the trial court get off track on this? If that's what's been going on, what suddenly happened here?
Without getting into the personalities involved, which I think is probably not appropriate,
that statement alone gives me a clue. So
it was intended to. the magistrate hung his hat on an issue that you all have alluded to, which is that this money is somehow the child's money. That I can't quote him exactly, but it is to the effect of the parents are not free to contract away the child's rights. Okay. He makes that statement without any legal support, without any legal authority, and there isn't any authority. In fact, the authority is to the contrary. The situation is this. The state legislature has determined that at a given amount of income with both parents, X number of dollars is sufficient to provide support for a child. It then allocates that burden of support based on the percentage of income. If the mother is not getting the support that the father owes her, and I apologize for being a little sexist there, but that is typically the way it works out, mother has still supported the child. It's not like the child has been neglected. So the law of Ohio is that support, once past due, is owed to the mother and not to the child. And there are specific cases, in fact, where the child, having attained the age of majority, attempted to claim that money. And the courts have said no. Arrearage is a judgment in favor of the mother designed to reimburse her for the money that she has already spent in supporting the child. So, Justice Stratton, I think you're correct in that the money that we're talking about is relevant to the child's best interest. But in point of fact, it is the custodial parent's money. It is reimbursement of funds that they have already spent, presumably to advance the child's best interest.
Mm-hmm. Isn't the argument, it seems to me, of both of you is that neither 83 nor .84 apply.
It absolutely is the argument that they do not apply.
It's just the parties can agree and they can come in and they can file something with the court. The judge or magistrate don't have anything to do with it. The parties have agreed to this, and they theoretically know what's best for them and the child, and so point 83 and point 84 just are not applicable. That's basically your argument.
That's exactly the argument. And you can get there a couple of different ways. The specific language of point 83 talks about an obligor's duty to pay. Now, if the obligor and the obligee have agreed that the money's not owed, then I don't think there's a duty to pay, and so the statute by its own terms does not apply. I think probably the most persuasive indication that the statute doesn't apply is the public commentary by the people that are responsible for that statute being in existence. We have a code of federal regulations. There are various requirements imposed on the states by the feds. There are requirements in the sense that if the state wants federal reimbursement, federal assistance for a child support program, the state has to comply with the federal regulations. One of those federal regulations is that the state pass a law that prohibits the retroactive modification of child support. That's what we're talking about here.
But don't you need a court intervention to at least journalize an order? Because we have an outstanding court judgment which affects credit, follows that individual through his or her whole life. And so you have the need for some judicial act to make a record of what the parties have agreed to.
I agree completely. I'm not suggesting that this can happen without any judicial act whatsoever. There are, in effect, two record keepers here. CSEA, my agency, keeps track of the numbers, how much is owed. But we can't act alone. We have some administrative powers. But by and large, we like to confirm what our records show with a court entry. And so you're absolutely right.
I'm not clear. I thought in answer to my question, you said that neither a judge nor a magistrate has anything to do with it if the parties agree to the support obligation.
Perhaps I misunderstood your question, which I thought was, does the statute apply? My position is that 3119.83 does not apply.
Okay, so
that's different than saying no judicial interaction at all, I think.
Okay, you made a very keen distinction there. In answer to Justice O'Donnell's question, it seems to me you're saying that the court 8384 out of it, but the court, through a magistrate or the clerk or the judge, must enter an order.
There should be an entry, yes. And I think actually Mr. Pattison's analogy to any other form of judgment is probably a good one. If I have a judgment, if a landlord has a judgment against me for $1,000 for damage I've done to an apartment, there is a record of that in two places, in fact, in the court's docket, in the eviction case, let's say, and in the office of the clerk of courts, which is the index of judgments. So, to continue the analogy, if I then pay off that judgment, there needs to be an entry of satisfaction of judgment so that the clerk's records properly reflect that I don't owe the money, and the clerk of court's index of judgments reflects that judgment is no longer in existence.
And Mr. Santin, using the language of the statute, you're saying that whatever the court is doing here, it is not modifying the duty to pay the support payment.
It is not retroactively modifying an obligor's duty to
pay.
What
is it doing?
It is. Again, I have to go back to the legislative intent and what the drafters tell us.
Let's look at the language of the statute, that the court may not modify the duty. What is it doing then when it signs the order?
It is granting judicial approval of an agreement that eliminates the duty prior to the court ever being involved.
Isn't that a modification if you eliminate?
If the parties have gotten together, if mother and father have gotten together and mother says, prior to any court involvement, Father, you don't owe me any money because you've signed off on the adoption, which is what happened here.
But there was a judgment prior to that establishing the obligation, and there may have been litigation and proceedings that would reduce that to judgment.
That's correct.
And that is done periodically, and then that's accumulated,
yes,
as it was here.
Yes.
And then there's a lump sum that is owing as of a certain date, and then the tab keeps running.
The tab keeps running until mom says, the tab has stopped running, or actually the tab is forgiven. If mom says you don't owe me the money, it's my position that under the statute, there is no duty to pay, and therefore the statute does not apply.
Well, then you can only look at that as a prospective application of the statute. In other words, I mean, this is really, in my mind, a little convoluted to say that the court can't modify a past judgment. In other words, it can't say, in 1999, you were obligated to pay $200 a week, but in 2008, we're modifying that judgment to say that you are only obligated to pay $50 a week. Is that what you're saying, that you can't go back and do something, but prospectively you can modify it by eliminating it?
I read the statute as if it said without the consent of the obligee.
Well, then we have to put words in there that we're not allowed to do.
Well, unless you look at the intent and the comments of the people who drafted the statute, which say that, which says to me that that language should be read in there.
Does this require action by the General Assembly to either eliminate the word not to say child support? A court may retroactively modify an obligor's duty to pay?
It doesn't require it, but it wouldn't hurt. I think, in my mind, the PIQ, forget the number 99, it's attached to our brief as Appendix 4, is very clear, makes a very clear distinction between the purpose of this statute and the situation that happens when parents agree to forgive arrearage. And so in my mind, the people that wrote this statute made a distinction between an involuntary or adversarial, if you will, modification retroactively, and a modification by agreement.
What do we do about the court and satisfaction that's really not? The father's threatened, the father's coerced, the father said, I'm going to do X if you don't sign off. And so they come into court with this agreement, and there's no court supervision to say, Mom, you know, were you coerced to do this? Were you forced to do this? I mean, that's the problem, is in most debtor situations, you don't have that absolutely unequal bargaining position with children as pawns. You have so many factors in a forgiveness of a debt in a child arrearage that just don't exist in a normal contract case. And so I have trouble accepting the normal contract analogy as justification for something that we know has so many other influences in it that can affect judgment.
Because children are involved, it creates an additional bargaining chip, if you will, and I agree with that. And I thought long and hard about whether to say to the court, look, these agreements should happen without any judicial oversight whatsoever. It would be most economical for my agency if that were the rule that the court articulates, that we can do this without notice and hearing. Is that the best thing for the child? Is that the best thing for the parent? I'm not so sure. It would not be the end of the world from my agency's point of view if the court's rule was these require notice and short hearing. It's not the result I'm asking for, but it would be better than affirming what the court below did.
Why couldn't this be done by applying point 84, and the parties would file a petition? There'd be a waiver of notice. That statute requires notice. And then final order concerning the petition for modification is entered. The parties agree to an order.
That is an elegant and creative solution that had not occurred to me. The point 84 statute talks about, it sets the date of notice as the very most backwards date that we can modify to. And I suspect that if we tried that solution, I might well wind up here in a year. Trying to persuade you that a waiver of the notice obviated that early date requirement.
There's no early date. What are you referring as an early
date? In 84, I believe, it says, again, I'm going to paraphrase, but the court can retroactively modify arrearage back to the date that notice of motion to modify is first given to the obligor.
Perhaps the version I'm reading is a court with jurisdiction over a court of support order may modify an obligor's duty to pay a support payment that becomes due after notice of a petition to modify the court's support order has been given to each obligor and to the obligee and obligor before a final order concerning the petition for modification is entered.
Yes,
so you're saying
that doesn't make a retroactive. I mean, that doesn't reach a retroactive.
83 says then if
83 refers, accepts out 84.
Except after notice is given.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you're saying that only applies to modifications of obligations going forward?
Sure. I'm saying that applies when you have an adversary situation, when you do not have agreement. And if you look at the entire statutory section, it in fact deals with motions to modify, contested motions to modify. It's my contention that when the parties agree, that the court ought to approve that agreement. So I would ask that the court reverse the court below and remand the case with instructions that this agreement be approved and validated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Santin. Mr. Patterson, you saved just about a minute of your time.
I appreciate the court's indulgence in this argument. The modification occurs as a result of the agreement of the parties, and it's not a situation where somebody just goes in and files a motion and asks for it to happen and asks for the judge to rule on it, and the other side does not agree. The older cases are that. They're essentially relitigating child support. We don't want to do that. We want to deal with it as a judgment and a satisfaction or a modification. I've thought long and hard also. And I've looked at it from the point of view of the system and making the system more efficient for parties so it wouldn't cost them money, wouldn't have to hire attorneys when it's not necessary that they're in agreement. So it could happen maybe just approaching the Child Support Enforcement Agency.
But counsel, there still needs to be an order on signed by the court sanctioning the agreement.
Not for if it's treated as a satisfaction.
Well,
of a judgment.
So then that would just be filed with the clerk of courts?
Yes.
Signed by the two parties?
Yes.
And you don't see the need for any court approval or oversight, including the determination of the best interest of the child?
Right. Satisfactions are entered every day in the most contentious cases in the world. And they just write them up, sign them, and take them and file them with the clerk. Maybe it's noted on the judge's card, maybe it's not. That's it. It's released. If there's a problem with that, it can come back to court easily. If they're sent out as a result of the satisfaction, then so be it. If there's fraud or 60B and so forth like that. There's an unequal bargaining position. Landlords and tenants and everybody in the world. This is the more and more and more I looked at this case, simple satisfaction of a judgment issue.
But I one of the things that is concerning me in this situation, there is a good result for the child because theoretically the child will be adopted by the stepfather. There will be an individual who will support this child in lieu of the non-supporting father that's been part of his life. So it's a win here for the child. But I think in terms of a mother who may not be looking for a step-parent adoption arrangement and goes into the Child Support Enforcement Agency like you're suggesting, sits down there with and consents to a coercive statement or a coercive position created by, you know, a bullying father of her child, and no matter what the motivation is. And that troubles me here.
I understand that. It can happen in any type of a case, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's the process, that you have to have a full hearing or presume that it's going to happen. You can presume that it's not going to happen, that the parents are defending the best interests of their children. These are parties. The children are not parties to this. We're dealing with parties. The parties own the judgment. It's just an ordinary judgment. If you don't look at it that way, I think you make it more complicated, or you end up throwing out the whole idea of judgments the child support, as it becomes due, becomes a judgment, which I agree with. The statute's supported. It's briefed. So you've got that issue. I think it can be handled very, very simply and appropriately.
You've used your time, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Judge or Justice.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
Thank you very much.
Marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye.